here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. Monday, April 20th, 2009, is a date that is a strange mixture of three very different things that have, well, come together as one. The first, of course, is that April 20th is Yom HaShoah. It is the day in the Hebrew calendar, Nisan, the 27th of Nisan, that commemorates the victims of the Holocaust. April 20th is also Hitler's birthday, a date celebrated by neo-Nazis worldwide who want to finish what Hitler did not complete. Hitler only killed one-third of every Jew, of all the Jews in the world. And those that celebrate Hitler's birthday obviously want to kill the remaining two-thirds. Monday, April 20th, was also the opening day of the Human Rights Conference, specifically the UN Conference Against Racism in Geneva, Switzerland, that has been called Durban 2 because of the first UN Conference on Racism that occurred in 2001. That conference famously devolved into one of the most vicious anti-Semitic attacks that anyone can remember from a UN conference in modern times, probably since the 1975 declaration, since rescinded, that Zionism is racism. But there they sold the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. There they had pictures of Jews with, I'm talking about Durban 2001, because I'm going to get to Geneva 2009 in a second. But there they had pictures of Jews that could rival any Nazi poster, with large noses and fangs and wads of money. And the Jews that were there were yelled out. People screamed, Jew, 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 and they very much, some of them were physically accosted and feared for their lives. In 2009, when the Conference on Racism was proposed again, there was a real question of whether or not the United States government should participate. The people housing the conference were trying to be very careful not to repeat what had happened 8 years ago. Well, how careful they were, I don't know. Geneva was no doubt better than Durban, and I want to talk about that during this hour. But they also, of course, gave the microphone to perhaps the leading anti-Semitic leader, the head of Iran, Ahmadinejad, who proceeded to state that the creation of Israel was, and I want to get the exact language right here. Let's get this. Oh, I'm going to have to pull it up here. Okay, I will get it for you, the exact language. I've prepared so many different things for today, it's hard to find them all. He basically said that following World War II, the Western powers used the pretext of Jewish suffering in the Holocaust to resort to military aggression to make an entire nation homeless. In other words, what Ahmadinejad is saying is that Hitler was killing the Jews in Europe as a pretext to destroying Arabs in Palestine. He originally called it the ambiguous and dubious question of the Holocaust, and later the question of the Holocaust. But what happened in Geneva was very different than what happened in Durban, South Africa. First of all, it wasn't just the United States and Israel that refused to participate. There was also a dozen other countries, the Netherlands and Germany and Poland and a whole host of other nations, Australia and Canada. But even the nations that were there, when Ahmadinejad spoke, when he said what he said, large numbers of them walked out. Everyone to the Czech Republic, to France, to Austria, to a whole host of European nations. And it was a very different atmosphere from the one in Durban. those that were in Geneva note that, first of all, unlike in Durban, there was a large presence of people who supported the rights of the Jewish people to exist and were actively going out and responding to people who were saying hateful things, partly, admittedly, because they felt a lot safer in Geneva, Switzerland, than they did in Durban, where there were physical threats. But I raise all this because it's important, I think, on the day of Holocaust remembrance. It's important to go back, I think, to first principles. And I was trying to think about how to characterize what we should do on a day of Holocaust remembrance when we have a conference on racism. It doesn't focus on the real genocide occurring today, right now, among the people of Darfur, where hundreds of thousands, close to a million men, women, and children have been massacred for the last 5 years and are continually being massacred today. Interestingly, the killers and the victims are both Muslim. The killers are Arab, the victims are black. One would think that a conference on racism would focus on an ongoing genocide where white people are killing black people and not killing people who oppose government policies, but simply wiping out every last man, woman, and child. Not in the dozens or the hundreds or the thousands, but in the hundreds of thousands. And while Geneva was certainly an improvement over Durban, how could it not be? The fact that Elie Wiesel, a person who lost all his family to the Nazi atrocities, a person who lost his parents and all his brothers and sisters and virtually his entire extended family, and who has devoted his life to trying to teach how we should prevent genocide from happening again. And lo and behold, a member of Ahmadinejad's own contingent, the someone from the Iranian government, was shouting at Elie Wiesel, Zion Nazi. Connecting, think about this, connecting Elie Wiesel with the vicious barbarians who had murdered his entire family. It would be as if someone said to Emmett Till's mother — Emmett Till, of course, is the young black teenager that was lynched by a mob for supposedly whistling at a white girl, whether he did or he didn't — it'd be like telling Emmett Till's mother that she is a racist murderer. It's so bizarre, and yet it is what constitutes, well, the feeling of a whole group of people. At any rate, I was trying to sort of figure out how to think about all of this. And I was reading in the Huffington Post from the French philosopher Bernard-Henri Lévy talking about the Holocaust. And he writes, "The crime, they say, was a grave crime to be sure. But how can you say it was a greater crime than all other crimes? And why should anyone insist on declaring it an exception in the series of evil deeds that is the very framework of human history?" He writes, "We are not insisting on anything. Nothing is more alien to the Jewish idea of death than establishing any kind of scale or hierarchy of death. Except that here again, something happened in the Shoah that finds itself, and that's just the way it is, without precedent. And this something is a manhunt and a massacre that meant not only the absence of any trace of a tomb, but also the impossibility for the victims to find a place, any place, to escape their executioners. The Armenians who were, and this is too often questioned, the victims of the first genocide in history, were only pursued in Turkey, I disagree that the Armenians were the first genocide in history. There certainly were others in the past, but perhaps the first genocide in modern history. This is Mark commenting, not Bernard Henri Lévy, but he's making a point, I think an important one. The Armenians, who were the, and this is too often questioned, meaning that it shouldn't be questioned, and I agree with him on that, who were the victims of the first genocide in history, were only pursued in Turkey. The Tutsis, the Cambodians, the Darfuris, whose genocide should be denounced with the same force, could, at least in theory, should they have found asylum in a neighboring country, could escape the murderer's clutches. There was no such escape for the Jews targeted by a Shoah that intended to be their complete destruction. All of Europe, and soon thereafter, in theory, the entire world, became an immense trap for the Jewish game hunted by the Wehrmacht's dogs and the SS. An extermination, it is that which is excruciatingly singular, that offered no recourse because it wanted to leave no remnant, no remains. This notion of total extermination is important for yet another very precise and concrete reason, namely Israel. The Shoah did not cause Israel to come into being. And we must do everything, truly everything, to break the insidious claim that in linking the two ends up imputing a providential cause to, and whether we want it or not, justifying the Shoah. The Hebrew word for the Holocaust. This is Mark on a side point. You know, this is what the Christian right does. This is what some of the Christian pastors that supported John McCain have done. They've imputed a providential purpose in connecting Israel to the Holocaust. They have done really the exact same thing that Ahmadinejad has done in reverse. Ahmadinejad has said that the Nazis were an evil plot to establish the State of Israel, which sounds ridiculous. It's also ridiculous, as the Christian pastors have said, to suggest that the Holocaust was a providential plot, was given by God to establish Israel. Both sides are dangerously ridiculous. Bernard Henri Lévy continues, all the same, there is another inanity heard all over, which consists of the following, quote, yes, all right, it was a crime. Yes, if absolutely necessary to admit, a singular crime. But as for the survivors of the tragedy, why weren't they moved to Germany? Why a national Jewish homeland in the Arab world, the only part of the world that did not take part in the crime? And the answer remains that the world itself was a trap for Jews. There wasn't a single part of the world where the evil wind of this death didn't blow. And the Arab world did not recuse itself any more than the rest of the world from this plan of total extermination. Today we have very detailed information on the matter. We have the memoirs of the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem describing relentlessly during the entire duration of the war, his admiration for Hitler. We have the work of historians citing the existence of an Arab SS legion waiting at the rear guard of Rommel's army for the order to descend on the Jewish community in the land of Israel in order to exterminate the 500,000 Jews who had already settled there. We know, in other words, that Nazism was a global ideology. They manifested itself in national versions, and in particular in an Arab version, no less criminal than the European version. This changes nothing, quite the contrary, when it comes to the necessary fight for democracy in the Arab world, and in particular in the Palestinian state to come. This is simply an argument for honesty, an argument to oppose relentlessly those who, sustained by ignorance related to an absence of memory, try to delegitimize Israel, and who sometimes unfortunately succeed. I found this comment by the French philosopher very powerful. And it reminds me of those days, that it wasn't a Nazi plot to exterminate the Jews. It was indeed a worldwide plot. In all the countries of the world in 1939 to 1945, there was only one city on earth, and it didn't advertise it very much, where Jews were allowed to live, albeit in a prison camp, and that was Shanghai, China. The United States closed its doors, sent the refugees back to the concentration camps. England violated international law and closed its state, the Mandatory State of Palestine, despite the fact that it was required to allow Jewish settlement there, simply violated international law and literally sent the Jews back to Germany. The Arabs, as have been noted, worked with Hitler, with the head of the Palestinian Arabs at that time, although they weren't called Palestinians at the time, the head of the Arab community in Jerusalem, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, literally meeting with Hitler and asking him to bring those same Wehrmacht vans, the ones that had killed hundreds of thousands of Jews in Russia, to bring their gas, their extermination, to the Jews living in British Mandatory Palestine. And if it had not been for the Allied armies in North Africa, certainly they would have been massacred as well. So Henri Levy brings an important point. This was a worldwide, and probably, well, almost certainly, the only worldwide genocide that has ever occurred. A lot of people do not know the history of the United States, do not know that in the 1930s they had people like Father Coughlin on the radio arguing strenuously that the Jews were the reason for the Depression, the reason for the United States being in poverty. A lot of people do not know the Gallup polls taken in 1940, 1941, 1943, 1944, 1945, where Americans rated the greatest dangers to the United States of America. Gallup poll, very reputable polling organization. Germany was number 3. Japan was number 2. The Jews were number 1. Now, we've come a long way since World War II. No question about it. I dare say that Jews are freer in the United States of America than any country on earth, possibly including Israel, because, you know, Jews are less subject to terrorist attacks in the United States than in Israel. But it's important, I think, on Holocaust Remembrance Day to realize how a people, any people, whether they be Jews or Darfuris or Armenians, or in the case of the Holocaust, gypsies and homosexuals, or even those that are mentally disabled or physically disabled, can be turned into the other. And here we have a conference in Geneva that ignores an ongoing genocide, that ignores the real existence of slavery that continues in countries like Mauritania. That's not often talked about. In order to invite, as its premier speaker, the head of Iran. So I'm glad people walked out. I'm glad that President Obama decided not to attend. And I recognize that the conference is infinitely better than what happened in Durban 8 years ago. But I also recognize that this kind of thing does little to resolve real problems, whether the problem be Palestinian Arab suffering, or whether the problem be the suffering of the people in Iran, journalists imprisoned for their views, people tortured. Now, I did an entire show yesterday on the torture we committed in the United States, under our government. And I would very much like to see the torturers punished, particularly at the highest levels. And so, yes, of course, I support the impeachment of Judge Jay Bybee. I support the trial. Got to have a trial. I believe in due process. But this is the trial of Dick Cheney. And I realize it's not going to happen. Almost certainly not going to happen. But at the same time, I think it is important to recognize the difference between a democracy and a dictatorship. While I want to see those that committed torture in America punished, I at least recognize that the American people had the power to elect a new president who banned torture. And for all I disagree with President Obama saying he wants to look forward and not look back, I understand it. I just disagree with it. I recognize that in a democracy we can vote for change. And yet the United Nations in Geneva put in charge the country of Libya, a country that continues human rights violations. And it's fascinating because there was a Palestinian man who had been imprisoned in Libya for 5 years, brutally tortured. They claimed that he was trying to inject AIDS into babies. Heard that claim before? And he tried to address the Libyan government, who was supposedly doing something on racism, supposedly a claim of human rights. And he tried to bring up human rights to the Libyan delegation, and he was drowned out. I think any time we look at the political agendas of countries, and maybe that's what's always going to happen in the United Nations, rather than looking simply at human suffering, I think we can say worldwide that torture is wrong. And yet, if we only say, as the right says, that torture is wrong when done by our enemies, by countries like Iran and North Korea, and we don't look internally at the United States, then I think we are guilty of putting politics over human rights. And yet, if we only look at the United States and the things that we have done wrong, if we only look at U.S. torture, and we don't look at the dangers in the rest of the world, and we don't recognize that the Muslim, well, I won't say Muslim world, let's just say the Arab countries that were at the Durban conference did not want to focus on Arab oppression, then I think we have the same problem. There should be one standard of human rights. And there are levels of evil. There's a difference between fighting a war. There's a difference between self-defense. And a difference between intentionally throwing political opponents in jail and torturing them. There's a difference between torturing the guilty, which in my view is not allowed, is wrong, is evil, causes more harm than it's worth, and torturing the innocent, which is actually an even greater crime. As I look at what happened in Geneva, there's plenty of blame on all sides. There were the people with clown masks that came in to, emphasize what a huge circus all of this was. And they interrupted Ahmadinejad's speech, and that's not right, even though I certainly think Ahmadinejad's a clown. He's a dangerous one. But I don't believe in interrupting a speech of people you disagree with. So I'm glad they were arrested. I assume that they thought they might be arrested. That's kind of what civil disobedience is all about. The right way to go about it was what the Europeans did. They simply walked out. Or to do it the way Obama did. He simply didn't attend to begin with. But the sad thing is that there is still racism in the world. And there's racism in the United States. There's racism in Israel. There's racism in all the Arab countries. There's racism in, I believe, virtually all of the European countries. There's racism in South America. God knows there's racism in Asia and in Africa. And that's what not what was focused on. The plight, for example, of the Indian underclass, the so-called untouchables, the bottom of the caste in India. Now, India is a terrific democracy. I got to give a lot of credit for the most, the second most populous nation on earth, more than a billion people, able to have a democracy in a very poor country. I give India a lot of credit. But the problems of the lowest caste should have been discussed. And I think the way to discuss racism is to focus on individuals and individual actions. To focus on mistreatment, whether it be of women or minorities. And instead of creating false histories and doing things for political reasons, maybe we just need to talk about how racism affects ordinary people. How it is that in, I think, every country on earth, you're more likely to give a job, I don't want to say you, let's just say many people, are more likely to give a job to their friends and their neighbors and people they know who are often of their same ethnic heritage than somebody else, perhaps, of a different race or hue or religion or color or nationality. When are we going to have a discussion on that? And that affects the United States. That affects, I think, every country on earth. How do we come to a human understanding in a way that stops genocides from occurring, recognizes that, yes, countries and peoples are always going to fight over land and power, but does so in a way that creates one standard of human rights across the globe, where torture is condemned, yes, but condemned equally, whether it occurs in the United States, or whether it occurs far more severely, I should say, in China and North Korea and Iran. I think it's important when we criticize the United States, as I have, well, I don't want to say criticize the United States. That's the wrong word. I got to stop myself. When we criticize the policy of a democratic government, we make clear that we're criticizing the policy of a democratic government. It is perfectly fair and reasonable to say that I believe the Bush administration is wrong, that they made wrong decisions, that they tortured people. I don't think it is fair to condemn the entire United States for the actions of the Bush administration. It's perfectly fair to say the Israeli government is wrong about this, that, or the other, and they made mistakes and they did these things wrong, fine. But it's not okay to say that Israel should no longer exist. The same actually is true about dictatorships as well, except that we have to recognize that the people have no power in those cases. The people of North Korea, I feel sorry for them, as I do for the people of Iran. The people of Iran happen to be some of the most pro-American people in the Middle East, largely because their government is so focused on denying the Holocaust that they're not providing for the people and enriching uranium, that they're not providing for the people of Iran. I do think these are important distinctions and the kind that should be made. And I do think that the occasion, whether it's Holocaust Remembrance Day or Hitler's birthday or the Geneva Conference, should remind us at the end of the day that democracies are perfectible in a way that dictatorships are not. We are certainly not perfect. We will never be perfect. But our Constitution talks about forming a more perfect union. And the beauty and wonder of democracy is that people can vote and change and make each place a more perfect union. And my trouble with the United Nations is that most of the states, even today, that constitute the United Nations, are not democracies. When the leader of China speaks, is he speaking for a billion Chinese people? Or is he speaking for the Chinese government? Now, that doesn't mean democracy is perfect. When Bush spoke in 2001, I would argue he was speaking for the minority of Americans, since the majority voted for Al Gore. But he was speaking for a good 48%, 49% of Americans. But the Chinese leader speaks for him and a few of his cohorts, and the same is true for the Iranian leader. So I don't think we should ever mistake the United Nations for world opinion. It may reflect it, it may not. At the same time, I think that democracies need to pull together and have a conference on racism and talk about the real racism that exists both in democracies and in dictatorships. And I think they can do so in a way that reflects what people actually think rather than what some leaders think. I do want to hear from you on anything I've raised today. It's 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. We'll be right back after this.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. The case for nationalizing a few of the biggest banks gets simpler the more complicated their role is in the current financial crisis. We should nationalize Citigroup and Bank of America and J.P. Morgan Chase not only because they deserve to be, but also because doing so would help untangle the economic knot. First, a truly nationalized bank could start lending right away. It wouldn't have to worry about toxic assets weighing it down because it'd have the U.S. Treasury behind it. And second, if we owned the banks, we could give much more favorable terms to GM and Chrysler on the loans that these very banks had given them. At the moment, for instance, J.P. Morgan Chase and Citigroup are refusing to write down Chrysler's debt to them to about 15 cents on the dollar. But if we owned the banks, we could write that debt down or forgive it entirely, and the car companies and their workers could breathe a little easier. Even using the leverage that Treasury has at its disposal today, we could force the banks to forgive their loans to the auto companies in exchange for getting bailed out themselves. Instead, we're bailing out the banks, and they're refusing to bail out the auto companies. That makes no sense whatsoever. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Hoffman did a good speech here. I knew I had it somewhere, just had to find it in the break. What he said was, following World War II, the West resorted to military aggression to make an entire nation homeless on the pretext of Jewish sufferings and the abuse of the question of the Holocaust. His original draft says the ambiguous and dubious question of the Holocaust. When the United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said to him, to Iran, that actually the UN accepts that the Holocaust exists, and he did tone it down to the abuse of the question of the Holocaust. But what's interesting is that Ahmadinejad's claim, which is actually very similar to the Nazis' claim, he claims that Jews control the media. He claims that, in essence, Jews controlled the Nazis, which is really weird when you think about it. The West murdered all the Jews so that they could come to mandatory Palestine and create a country there and dispossess Palestinian Arabs. What's different, I think, is the fact that people are walking out. And that's a good thing. What's different, I think, is that people were prepared after Durban. The amazing thing is that Durban occurred right after, of course, in 2001, Israel had offered some 95%, some say more, some say a little less, of the West Bank to become a Palestinian state. It seemed like the least time that you would think that people would go in and do things like, you know, scream Jew, 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 and have protocols, the Elders of Zion, and have pictures of Jews with fangs and, frankly, physically attack the Jews that are there. But this time, I think people were ready, and I think people need to recognize how far we've come in that respect. I think even the United Nations was sickened, most of them, by Ahmadinejad's speech. And that's a good thing. The interesting thing is that right now, many of the Sunni Arab nations, and they have dictatorships as well, and they torture their people as well. I'm talking, of course, about United States allies like Egypt and Saudi Arabia. They're very nervous about Iran. They also don't want Iran to have nuclear weapons. They don't want Iran to be the head of the Middle East. And so even then, though, they don't criticize the Iranian leader's anti-Semitism. And I think that if Muslim nations would make that critical distinction between criticizing, condemning Israeli policies and anti-Semitism, then I think we could have some real good discussions with them about anything. Why can't they simply condemn Ahmadinejad's questioning the Holocaust? Is that so hard for them to do? Why can't they attack Libya's mistreatment of a Palestinian man who was very upset by his torture and came in? Why can't they condemn the ongoing genocide in Darfur? It's reported that Ahmadinejad was smiling when he gave his speech. He clearly likes the drama. He clearly likes making a fuss. And perhaps he thinks that it'll help him win the next Iranian election. It's hard to know. As usual, the real leader of Iran, Khamenei, the supreme leader, has said that no one in any way opposing the current state can run. I was hopeful that Mohammad Khatami, who is by no means pro-American, but compared to Ahmadinejad, he's a saint. He was a somewhat moderate cleric who ran Iran for, well, ran Iran. We understand the supreme leader runs Iran. He was the president of Iran for some 8 years, and unfortunately neither Bill Clinton nor mostly George Bush took advantage of the fact that he was reaching out to the West. He was going to run again in June, and I was quite excited about it. I reported, well, right here on the Inside Scoop, that ICE was hopeful. Yet he was denied the right to run. And yet with all of the criticism I've given on Iran today, I still support the decision of our president to try to negotiate with Iran. That may sound contradictory. Do I believe that Ahmadinejad has any hope of any kind of doing anything that would be reasonable or rational? Not really. But he's not the head of Iran. Khamenei is, the supreme leader is. And Iran has many things that, I mean, the people of Iran want many things from the United States. The people of Iran are sick of this. They want America as a trading partner. They want to reach out to the West. Many of them do not like the Islamic requirement of women to cover up and so forth. And there are many moderates in Iran. In fact, probably the majority. There are even some moderates in the Iranian government. Sometimes we have to deal with people we don't like. Kim Jong-il is even more extreme than Iran. There are no moderates in the North Korean government. And yet we have to deal with him. I think Obama is right to say that if you've got someone who runs an entire state, you should at least try. And if, as I expect, his reaching out is rejected, whether by Iran or North Korea, then by all means, take more forceful steps. But at least we try. And you know what? I expect him to be rejected. I expect Obama to be rejected, just as I expected the Republicans, I guess, to be the party of just say no. It's not just foreign enemies, but opponents as well. And yet, if we reach out and our hand is slapped down, as President Obama said in his inauguration speech, that's their choice. President Obama has made a clear and important distinction between his policies and those of the past administration. He has reached out to Muslims very specifically. He's reached out to Turkey, being the first Muslim nation he went to, and of course it's a secular nation and a very well-established democracy. And yet he is right to turn around, as I suspect he will do in a few days, and announce the truth, which is that the Armenians, who were massacred 100 years ago, that was a genocide. Because it was. And as much as I support the nation of Turkey, and I'm very happy to see it, it's clearly the most successful democracy of a country that has a majority Muslim population. You gotta call spade a spade. You gotta call genocide genocide. And while I think President Obama was appropriate not to insult his host right there and then, maybe, I think it's important to recognize the historic truth. And as much as Turkey is upset about this, you know, there's no one alive today in Turkey that committed that genocide. That genocide occurred at the end of World War I. If you assume that someone has to be, at least 18. Oh, let's say they have to be 16. To commit a murder and know what they're doing, even 16 is kind of young. They would have been born in 1902 and they'd be 107 today. If there is anyone who committed genocide in Turkey still alive today, there are not many and they're very old. I doubt there are any of them left. it's important to remember history. And I think one of the lessons of a Holocaust Commemoration Day is the importance of remembering history. Here in Washington, we are finally, and it's long overdue, we are finally on our way to building a museum of the African American experience. It's not a museum to slavery, but it will certainly talk about slavery, and it should. We have a Native American museum that talks about, well, you can call it genocide. In many extents it was, depending on which tribe. A lot of it was smallpox, but there's no question we wiped out more than 90% of the Native American population. And that's talked about. It's important for every nation, our nation and every nation, to recognize its history, to recognize the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I think the purpose of a commemoration of such an awful event is precisely to prevent it from ever happening again. And that's why it so saddens me that they had a conference and they didn't mention the ongoing genocide right now. I actually find that amazing. I find it amazing that President Obama has hardly mentioned Darfur at all. Are we tired of it? It's just, you know, it's too depressing. It's too depressing to talk about all the men, women, and children that are being killed day by day. It's just we have economic problems. We got healthcare problems. We got to talk about the bank bailout. Is that what it is? It's far away. It's in a country. We're not there. And the United Nations meets, and they have a whole conference on racism. And you have whites killing blacks in massive numbers, and no one speaks out. You know, I guess that's one of the reasons why I'm glad we didn't attend. There were two red lines, according to Samantha Powers, our delegate to the United Nations, that we had to follow in order to attend Durban 2 in Geneva. One was we didn't want simply a reaffirmation of the 2001 Durban conference that seemed to blame all the racism in the world on Israel. The other one, and this is another interesting problem, is we didn't want it to be considered a crime to defame a religion. We also didn't want the Iranians to exclude mention of the Holocaust. But that part, apparently, they were willing to get to, the Europeans were willing to just overrule the Iranians on that one. But the two we couldn't get by, one was the reaffirmation of Durban 1. The other one was this very strange idea that to defame a religion should be a crime. No defamation of religion should ever be a crime. My God, the defamation of religion were a crime, my poor colleague Bob Kincaid would be in jail by now. It's perfectly fair and fine to attack a religion, just like it's perfectly fair and fine to attack any idea. It's not always wise. It's not, I don't always agree. But there's a huge difference, and it's one that the world really, and I've got to say, I think they finally got it by the end of Geneva, the astonishing difference between attacking a religion and attacking individual adherents of that religion. It's one thing to say, I think Judaism is foolish, I think Christianity is wrong, I think the Prophet Muhammad was not such a good man. That's all free speech. You should be absolutely free to speak your mind. But when you say that those who practice Islam should be rounded up and killed, that's something else. When you say that the Jewish people, unique among the peoples of the world, should not be allowed to have a state of their own, when you say that there's no place on earth where the Jews should be free to live, that's not an attack on Judaism. That's an attack on people. When you say in Darfur, not that you think Darfuri lifestyle is bad, but that they all need to die, that's not an attack. That's not a defamation of a religion. That's an attack on people. Attack religion all you want. Attack non-religion all you want. Attack atheism as a moral practice. That's fine. But don't attack atheists. Simply say you believe they're wrong. You believe they're incorrect. Fundamentalist Christians. I believe they are fundamentally incorrect. But I wouldn't round them up and do anything with them. I wouldn't say they don't have a right to exist. I wouldn't talk about wiping them off the planet. It's a fundamental distinction, and I think it's one that's sometimes lost by people who are too quick to say, hey, don't criticize my religion, don't criticize my country. Criticize religions, criticize countries, criticize governments. That's free speech. But watch it when you declare any people to be wrong. Isn't that the essence of what racism is all about? Isn't the essence of prejudice, of prejudging, when you say that a people is wrong? When you say that a nation is wrong? Martin Luther King, Jr., once said that when people criticize Zionism, they mean Jews. Dr. King was writing in August 1967, in his letters to an anti-Zionistic friend. You declare, my friend, that you do not hate the Jews. You are merely anti-Zionist. When people criticize Zionism, they mean Jews. This is God's own truth. Anti-Semitism, the hatred of the Jewish people, has been and remains a blot on the soul of mankind. Or as leftist Hans Meyer wrote, whoever attacks Zionism but by no means wishes to say anything against the Jews is fooling himself and others. The state of Israel is a Jewish state. Whoever wants to destroy it, openly or through policies that can affect nothing else but such destruction, is practicing the Jew hatred of yesterday and time immemorial. The point is that every country should be criticized. But don't attack that very nation. One of the things President Obama has been very careful about in praising Persian culture, and let's face it, Persia has a very long history of culture and positive influences on the world. The Persian Empire dates back certainly to antiquity. It's older than the Roman or Greek empires. In fact, it brought a great religion on this earth that unfortunately is too little practiced today, Zoroastrianism. It's a proud culture, a proud people. Arabs, it's a proud culture, a proud people. Arabic numerals are very, very useful things. And while Europeans were slogging around in the mud, it was the Arab nations that kept a lot of the world scholarship alive. Whether it's African cultures or Asian cultures or Native American cultures or South American cultures, there's good all over the planet. Peoples should never be attacked. Every people has a right to exist. Every people has a right to practice their religion in peace, to speak their own language, to teach their values to their children, with one exception. And it's an important one. People do not have the right to be intolerant of others. Your rights exist. As far as, you know, they say you can throw, I have the right to throw my arm as far as I can as long as it doesn't hit your face. And it's perfectly fair to condemn intolerance. One of the things that the right-wing Christians often do when they're attacking gay rights is they say we're intolerant of Christianity if we suggest that Christianity is intolerant of gay people. Kind of strange. And I fully admit, I've talked about this before, I fully admit to being completely intolerant of intolerance. I am bigoted against bigots. And I hope it's the only bigotry I have. All right, I admit it. I kind of hate smokers too. I don't hate them. I feel bad for them. I think they're making the wrong moral choice. I'll put that aside for now. But on the question of bigotry, as we remember Yom HaShoah. I think we need to speak out against it wherever it occurs. And we need to distinguish between attacking the policies of one government and attacking an entire nation or an entire people. And I actually, at the end of the day, think that Geneva was a real improvement over Durban. And my hope is at the next UN conference on racism, or perhaps the next conference on racism, it doesn't have to be run by the UN. Maybe the United States should hold a conference on racism here in the United States and invite all the leaders of democratic nations to attend. At the next conference on racism, let's not just talk about government actions. Let's talk about individuals. Let's talk about prejudging. Let's talk about when you consign an entire people to a certain belief. We need to talk about racism. But we need to do so in a way that has one standard worldwide. I need to tell you, just by the way, of course, you're still welcome to call in, 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. We've got a few minutes left. I do want to tell you that Bob Kincaid's show, unfortunately, is going to be a rerun tonight. You will hear Bob live tomorrow. And also tomorrow, you're going to hear something that you may not have heard before. Every Friday, it used to be you always heard a rerun on Friday, but every Friday you're going to hear me and two other hosts in a local radio program called Dialogue on WPFW in Washington, D.C. And starting tomorrow, you will hear a triple-hosted program every Friday between myself and Garland Nixon and Terry Kester, who are my colleagues at the local radio station. So I hope you'll start tuning in on Friday. You will hear a new show on the horn every Friday. And we talk about the issues of the day. Tomorrow's topic will be actually marriage equality in D.C., whether or not it's the proper time for it. We've also had dialogues on everything from poverty to racism to, well, you name it. That's part of what we do. So I hope you'll tune in every Friday to Dialogue. And like I said, Bob's going to be a rerun tonight. But this way, every Friday, it won't be the inside scoop, but you will hear me with two local radio hosts. You can know a little bit about them. Terry Kester is a long-time, I don't know how to describe him. He's a guy who's been a scriptwriter, a radio talk show host, a producer. He has a long history. He's been around a long time. He's taught university. He's taught theater. Garland Nixon has his own radio show. Garland is African-American, and he's in his 40s. Terry is white, and he's in his, I don't know how old Terry is, but he's significantly older than the two of us. And we talk about, give a lot of different perspectives. So I hope you'll tune in every Friday to that dialogue. And tune in next week for more of the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine, signing off.